Welcome to Catholic Sports View on Immaculate Heart Radio. A look at the athletes and coaches who shaped the Trinity League. Exploring where athletics meets faith. Now, here is your host, Bob Gibson.
Thanks for joining us here this week. We kick off our show by talking with Dane Jaco. He is the head golf coach at Servite High School, also the freshman football coach, but golf has really become his game, and he has really taken to it, although originally it wasn't exactly what he set out to do. We had a recent chance to talk with head coach Dane Jaco. Coach, thanks for taking a couple minutes. We appreciate it.
Thank you for calling.
Absolutely. You know, we want to talk about the history of your program, all the heights that it's reached, the great golfers that have come out of your program. But I kind of want to start off by talking about your personal journey to becoming the golf coach at Servite. And I know it's an interesting one. You're really a football guy who became a golf coach, right?
That is correct. It was an interesting one. I was, I came to Servite to teach and to coach football, and I was walking from my office down the locker room one day, and old-time basketball coach Larry Walker was walking toward me, and he said, I hear you golf. And I said, well, I own a set of golf clubs. And he goes, come and see me after school. You're the new golf coach. And I said, coach, is this something we can talk about? And he goes, well, if you want to keep your job, I mean, I guess we could talk about it, you know. So it was pretty much on the lines of that, and, you know, we talked about it, and was willing to do whatever I needed to do to help out the school, but I don't know that I envisioned how this all played out through the years, but that was how it began.
What was your level of golf knowledge at the time in regards to how much you could teach it to somebody else?
That would pretty much be zero. I mean, you know, my dad and I, we played. My dad was an avid golfer. So, you know, from the etiquette side and, you know, knowing your way around a golf course and, you know, that type of thing, you know, I was fine. You know, but as far as the golf swing and, you know, the details of mapping a team together in golf and all that type of stuff, scheduling, you know, I had no clue.
Well, you were a three-sport guy yourself in high school. You went to Artesia High School. Like I said, football. I think you were a baseball guy as well, ran some track. What was your path? Did you think football was going to be your path all the way through?
I think, you know, football was always my first love. Well, let me back that up. I think baseball was always my first love. We, you know, the head baseball coach at Servite, Sean Gilbert, and I always joke because baseball is my first love. And football is his first love, so I don't know how this all played out. But, you know, I wanted to pick a college where I could do both, so I wound up back at Upper Iowa University in Iowa. And it was one of the few schools that would allow me to play both in college. And so I went back there and did both, and it all worked out. I enjoyed my time back there. So it was pretty much split, but I think, you know, football – I was leaning toward football, and then I went on to go to some camps in the USFL and the NFL and found out, you know, not big enough, not fast enough pretty quickly, and that was the end of that.
Right. I was going to mention, you did get a chance to play in the USFL, correct?
I did. I did for a brief time. You know, enjoyed that. I learned a lot. I think it helped me a lot, you know, in my coaching career. So it was brief.
We've read the stories. We've seen the documentaries. Was the USFL everything it's made out to be? You kind know, of the renegade league, you know?
Well, back then, you know, anybody that, you know, it's my age is going to tell you the same thing. I mean, you know, there was no concussion. It was, you got your bell rang, set out for a couple plays, and so you got your bearings straight, and, you know, and you're free to go back in.
Right.
Looking back on it, my friends and I joke about it. We probably had two dozen concussions, you know. We didn't know what that was, you know, but you did that playing at the schoolyard with your buddies, too.
Yeah.
So I have no regrets. The friendships and the people I met coming up through sports and football, I don't have any regrets. Absolutely not.
We're talking with Dane Jaco, the head golf coach at Servite High School. Was teaching the next logical step for you, or did you think you were going in another direction after that once your playing career was over?
I think toward the end of college, the path that I was going to take, I think coaching was a for sure thing. And I think teaching came pretty late, I want to say, my senior year. You know, I kind of joke about it. My path of coaching went backwards. You know, it started in college and went back to my alma mater and coached for 2 years. And then I came back to California and started coaching, you know, at Artesia, and it was varsity. And then when I came to Servite, it was varsity. And, you know, and then, you know, I've been the freshman coach going on 20 years at Servite now. But I knew pretty early on that coaching and teaching was going to be my calling.
Yeah. I always ask coaches, did Servite find you or did you find Servite?
Well, actually, I had a personal training business. I was coaching at Artesia, had a personal training business, and I was training a young man that was attending Servite and became friends with his father. And Servite was looking for possibly their first strength and conditioning coach, and had a meeting with Coach Toner back at that time, and took the position as their strength and conditioning coach. And it just so happened in the spring when I started, Servite only had one PE teacher back then. He was leaving for another position, and that position opened up, and I took the position, and 20-plus years later, this is where I am.
Dane Jaco is the head golf coach at Servite High School, also the freshman football coach. And I want to ask you about that, because how important is it to you to stay involved with football and to coach that freshman team? Really, these are the young Friars that are going to be the big stars of tomorrow, right?
Correct. My first year of coaching freshman football, when Coach Toner and I decided, I was going to move from varsity to freshman, that class is the class that had Matthew Slater, Ryan Khalil, Sean Estrada. You know, there were, I believe, five NFL guys in that class. And, you know, I look back and, you know, Ryan Khalil was a 135-pound center who couldn't block anybody that year.
No, that's not possible. You know, he was never 135 pounds. Couldn't be.
He was 135 pounds in a size 16 shoe.
Wow. He definitely filled into those shoes by the time he got to USC, that's for sure.
he definitely filled out.
You know, you talk about your own personal time playing football. You talked about the concussions. How different is the sport of football now than when you played?
Oh, night and day.
Yeah.
You know, you go out to the field and, you know, you'd have your dialogue with the trainers. But what I've personally found over the last few years is, if he says they're out, they're out. You're better off just not even questioning it, you know, because there's such a high level of concussion protocol now that they do. You know, everything's on computers. They take the test prior to the season. And, you know, if they do suffer a concussion, you know, they have to go through this whole protocol to get back on the field. You're in the loop, but you really never knew what the first test was and what the last test was. So, you know, that was never the way it was, you know, 20 years ago, that's for sure.
Yeah, right. You know, obviously you coach football, which is, I mean, it's a team game. I mean, you rely on the guy next to you literally to help get everything done within the context of a football game. And even though golf does have a team concept to it, it's still an individual sport. You're the only one out there, you know, swinging that club. Is that a nice dichotomy to be able to go from one that's a complete team sport to one that's an individual sport, for, you know, coaching wise?
I love the balance of the two, you know, the intensity of football and, you know, what that brings. And then, you know, to have a little bit of time off to jump right into the golf season. You know, usually I take a couple weeks off after the football season and then start right back with the golf and start to put together that team. I've been blessed with a lot of great players at Servite. So, you know, I usually only have to fill one or two spots each year. We really stress at Servite the team aspect of it. It is an individual sport, and once, you know, they tee off, you know, their score is an individual score. But, you know, we take a pretty different approach to high school golf and always put the team first and, you know, be smart when you're out there. You know, having a 9-hole match, you know, double and triple bogeys almost take you out of the match immediately as an individual. So we look at the high school golf aspects when we're playing these 9-hole matches, almost like a match play. You know, you got to know what the other kid's doing. You know, if he hits it in the water, you know, your strategy may change on that hole. You may not be as aggressive as you would have been if he didn't go in the water. So we still really look at this as a team aspect a lot more than maybe some other coaches do.
And it's also a little different in that you're not able to, once the players are on the course, you're not able to go up to them and give them direct coaching at that point, right? You kind of have to be off to the distance, you know, so to speak.
Well, that rule's changed recently.
Oh, has it? Okay.
It's been about 3 or 4 years now. I can talk to them as much as I need to talk to them from once they finish the hole on the green to they tee off on the next hole.
Interesting. I missed that rule change. Yeah. I'm glad that's changed because that makes a big difference, I would imagine.
Correct. It enables me to have some dialogue during the round and communicate with them how things are going. And you can make some minor adjustments, but can't really do much. You don't want to get in their head too much, you know, being out there.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's what you're working on during the week that you're trying to apply during match play, right?
Correct. I mean, we go into almost every match with a game plan. You know, we have our notes, and for the most part, we've played most of the courses. And so we have a game plan going in, and at times that game plan might change in the middle. It entitles me to, you know, tell a player, you know, how things are going in the match overall, when he can be more aggressive, when he needs to be less aggressive, you know, that type of thing, you know. But I can't really, like a caddy, I'm not bad. You know, I'm not going to go out there and change everything they're doing, and you know, from stroke to stroke.
Right.
But if somebody's not playing well or somebody's playing really well, and you kind of, you have a sense of how the match is going. So you can communicate that to the individual players.
Quick break here on Catholic Sports View, and we'll come back. We'll have more with Dane Jaco, the head golf coach at Servite High School. Stay with us here on Immaculate Heart Radio. Welcome back to Catholic Sports View here on Immaculate Heart Radio. Our guest is Dane Jaco. He is the head golf coach at Servite High School. Coach, as we were talking to you earlier, we found out that you had virtually no coaching experience as a golf coach. You were a football guy. So how does a guy with no experience as a golf coach go to a 7-time, you know, coach of the year? I mean, that's quite a meteoric rise within the golfing community.
Well, I would say that award goes to my players. Unlike football, I always joke about this with my golfers. I can go watch game film and I can put extra time in and come up with a game plan and, you know, and adjust in the middle of the game and call timeout. You know, all that goes with, you know, a normal team sport like football and golf. There is no substitutions. There is no timeouts. And, you know, the six kids you start in golf are the six you're going to finish with. So luckily I've been blessed with great players, and I've been blessed with kids that buy into my system and, you know, and overall the Servite way. You know, without those kids, I probably would not have had as near the success as I've had since I've been there. So
yeah.
That goes all to the players.
Do the boys come to you with varying skill levels? I mean, I would assume you have kids who have played a very long time and they come in and they're your top players, but do you have also kids that come in that are maybe just starting out playing the game?
Well, in the beginning, yes. I would say, gosh, it's been 7-8 years ago, you know, once I realized how much I enjoyed it and, you know, the team had some success, I started, I've always kind of been a goal person, and I've always written down things I want to get accomplished during the season, during the off season. And some of the goals that I wrote down was, you know, to start our own tournament, to establish more kids to get involved in golf at the school. You know, back then, you know, if you had a freshman and JV team, you know, that was about it. Well, you know, we're up to almost 50 kids involved in the golf program at Servite now, and I have 5 golf teams. And I, you know, one of the things I wanted to establish was to have a team for the individuals that maybe didn't want to play tournament golf during the summer and maybe wanted to do other curricular activities at Servite, you know, student government. They wouldn't allow them the time that it takes to become, you know, a college-level player. So we started, you know, this JV2 team. We call it the Lifetime Team, and that's the kids that stay in the program over 4 years. You know, they're able to play competitive golf even as a senior. You know, so we've had a lot of success. You know, we have 2 Frost-Off teams. The 1 Frost-Off team is, we have about 3 or 4 kids that have never picked up a club. So I have all levels of players in our program.
Is that where the coaching aspect comes in for you? I mean, maybe with some of the, you know, the Patrick Cantlay types. We'll talk about Patrick in a couple of minutes. But that level of golfer obviously maybe just needs some tweaks to his game. But, you know, some of these kids, as you mentioned there, maybe you can really help them out even more in trying to enjoy the game, I guess.
Definitely a lot more coaching at that level. You know, I have to have the right coach at those levels that are going to be willing to do a little bit more on hand. You know, and I've been lucky to find good coaches to coach at those levels, and it helps out a lot.
Yeah, how important is that? Talk about your staff. Tell us about the staff you have around you and how you've assembled them, because you're right. Those are the guys that are also working with some of these kids as well.
Well, at the beginning, it was just me and you know, a JV coach. And then it was shortly after that, you know, Patrick came along and, you know, and I started seeing the direction and that I wanted to take the program. I was lucky and fortunate to have a young man on campus, John Morris, which is Servite's head basketball coach. He helped me out at the freshman level in football, and he came aboard as the Frost soft coach that year. And, you know, the golf bug bit him, and he just went crazy over the game. And I brought him up the very next year, I believe it was, to be my assistant / JV coach. And through all of the success, John was right there with me, you know, helping with the notes and the travel and everything else. And as much credit as I get should go to Coach Morris, because he was right there with us. And then through the years, I've picked up a few more assistants that have been with me. This year, I have the last few years when John went to basketball, I got our former baseball coach, Todd Cook, to come aboard, and now he's the JV coach. And that's kind of the key to the success, is we haven't missed a beat. You know, a coach leaves the program, I've been able to bring in a coach to just pick right up where the previous coach left off. We don't miss anything. I have a former football player that first year that I talked about it, you know, with Ryan Khalil, Dan Kaus. He's my Frost soft coach. He runs everything at the lower levels. He's a Servite grad. So, you know, again, I keep repeating it. I've just been very, very lucky with the people that I've had around me. They deserve as much success, of the fame and, you know, the success that we've had as I do.
Dane Jaco, the head golf coach at Servite High School, is our guest this week on Catholic Sports View. You know, I mentioned the name Patrick Cantlay, and it's a name familiar to a lot of people in Southern California, many more in the golf community. You know, big time talent that came through your program. Is that the example of a kid who came in and it just all came easily to him?
Well, you know, with Pat, he was a very talented younger player. I have a really funny story about Pat. His dad was a Loyola grad. They lived over in Rossmore, and he was looking for a school. You know, his mom went to Connolly, so Servite was on the map. All his friends went to Mater Dei. So his dad brought him on a shadow day, and it was during the middle of the football season. And we sat down and spoke, and, you know, we've always stayed true to what we do. And he said, well, you know, what type of scores do I have to shoot to, you know, make varsity team? And I said, well, you're going to have to make freshman team first. And then once you get those scores down, then I will give you a tryout at JV. And once you have those scores, then I'll give you a varsity tryout. Well, I had no idea that meeting and how close I was that Patrick not even come to Servite, because when he got in the car, it was later that his dad and mom told me. He got in the car and he goes, I'm not going to school there. I'll never play for that guy. He's not going to give me a varsity tryout. Well, looking back on that, it was probably the best thing that I did, because that's exactly what his parents was looking for, was somebody to mentor their son and not, you know, basically give him his way all the time. And I think that's why Patrick and I in some ways have such a strong friendship. It was very, very quick. I gave him a freshman tryout. I think I made him do two, but it was apparent after about three holes the talent he had. And, you know, he came up as a freshman, and in his second high school match, he broke the course record at Western Hills shooting 31.
Wow.
Yeah.
You must have known pretty quick then, this is a kid that was going to give the Servite team a chance for the next 4 years.
Yeah, the seniors, I'd say typical seniors, did not welcome him open arms, but, you know, it's golf, it's not football, so it wasn't too bad. But, you know, Patrick's a unique individual. He, you know, we always joked he was 18 going on 58. But it took maybe a couple weeks for the guys to just keep their pride and go, look, we got a pretty talented kid here, and we're going to be a better team with this young man. And, you know, it took about a week or two, and it gelled pretty quickly.
Yeah, I bet it did. I mean, is he the most talented kid? I mean, you've had a lot of talented players come through the system, but does he kind of stand out at the top?
I would say he's had the most success up to this point.
Yeah.
During that time that I had Patrick, 1 year behind him was a kid named Preston Balders, which was at UCLA with him. And Preston is a very talented kid. He has status on the Canadian tour right now. He's going to start, you know, his season in June once Canada thaws out. You know, he had a great career up in at UCLA, and you know, I had Ryan Carter played on the Canadian tour. He was a little bit before me. Nico Bellini played at SC. Jordan Nasser, which I had my first year, he had a ton of success as an amateur player. So there's been a lot of good players come through Servite. You know, Patrick stands out, but there's been a lot of good ones.
You got a chance to caddy for Patrick a couple of times during the U.S. Amateur Open. How special was that to be able to take part in that with him?
Well, I look back on those specifically. You know, I caddied for him a few times in smaller events, but I look back on those 2 years as probably the most enjoyable 2 years of my coaching career. The family welcoming me in, and, you know, that week that we spent up at Chambers Bay, there were golds, but had no idea, you know, was going to go all the way to the semifinals. And then to come back the next year at Erin Hills, you know, to travel with them to Augusta and the two U.S. Opens, it was a dream for me.
A few years back, I interviewed Lee Trevino, and he told me he has to hit 500 golf balls a day minimum to stay at the level. I mean, is that the kind of time and effort you have to put into golf to stay that good at it and stay at that level?
I think each individual is different. You know, Patrick always had a saying, and I kind of stole it from him, even at a young age. He always said, practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect.
Mm.
You know, that saying sums it up, especially for a golfer, because, you know, there are guys out there, you know, that'll pound 1,000 golf balls a day. Then there's other guys that have everything mapped out, what they need to get done in that day. They get there and they get it done, and, you know, and they go home. And everybody's a little bit different, you know. And during that time that I spent with Patrick, I talked to people, I watched. I remember going to a Western Am with him in Chicago, and we had went to go have dinner with another host family, and then that the other host family was hosting Jordan Spieth.
Oh, wow.
You know, so to sit around the dinner table and to listen, the other young man was Jonathan Vega's brother, Julio, which was at Texas at the time, you know, and Jordan was going to be an incoming freshman. So, you know, so to listen to the talk and the dialogue of, you know, how they warm up and how they practice, how they approach practice rounds. That was my learning, and that was my school, and then brought it back to Servite Golf and just started applying all those things.
Well, Coach, we want to thank you for taking time. We want to wish you luck as you shoot for another Trinity League Championship this season. Thanks again for joining us here on Catholic Sports View.
Well, I want to thank you for spending the time. Thank you.
That's Dane Jaco. He is the boys' golf coach at Servite High School. When we come back on this edition of Catholic Sports View, we're going to revisit an interview we did with Daryl Miller now that baseball season has started. Stay with us. We'll be right back here on Immaculate Heart Radio. Welcome back to Catholic Sports View. My name is Bob Gibson. Well, another baseball season is upon us. We want to go back and revisit an interview we did a couple of months ago with Daryl Miller, former Angel catcher and player development executive. He helped launch the Urban Youth Academy out in the city of Compton, and he's launched many more since then nationwide. We got a chance to sit down with Daryl a couple of months ago and talk about his love of the game of baseball.
Daryl, we're going to touch on a lot of different aspects of your story here as we talk with you, but I want to talk about this beautiful facility here in the city of Compton, and I think it's one of the crowning achievements the Major League Baseball has done in the past several years is to put facilities like this together. There's several nationwide now, but this was the first one. When did baseball kind of talk about a need for these kind of facilities and for an urban youth academy to even exist?
Well, the idea started being thrown around in early 2000. There was a lot of people talking about what was being done in the Dominican Republic in regards to building these academies and developing kids, and they thought, well, why not utilize that concept in America, in the inner city? And RBI had just started, and it was going pretty well, but, you know, everyone started to realize brick and mortars were needed, you know, a facility that could stand alone and really help develop boys and girls and talk about baseball and talk about all the jobs around baseball. And so we were able to start the construction here in 2004, finish it in 2006, and we've been open for the last 10 years. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary last month.
Most of us come up playing, you know, Little League Baseball, you know, in our communities. Is that not enough anymore? Was there more of a need in certain communities to have facilities like this? Is Little League not enough?
Well, Little League is enough, but Little League's disintegrating as we know it when we were kids. It no longer exists. And then the competitive nature of all sports has just turned it up a notch. This whole club level thing that's been introduced, you know, probably starting in basketball and then in baseball and now in, you know, soccer and, you know, all the other sports. Football's still the only one that isn't a club. There's no real club. It's just expensive to play. But I think Little League struggled because it was predicated on a sound family fabric. Mother and father volunteering, putting the leagues together. And when you saw the social fabric disintegrate in America, you see some more single mothers than ever. Little Leagues have been struggling to be able to provide coaches, to be able to provide umpires, and that whole model of everyone volunteering and providing this at low or no cost or little or no cost has disintegrated. And so, you know, Little League struggling to get people to play, and travel ball became such a big thing where, you know, if you don't play travel ball, you're getting behind or taking lessons and all those types of things. So that played into this whole, you know, you have to get more kids the opportunity to play. And then it became really expensive. Baseball with a bat and a glove and cleats, the ordinary kid can't afford to play, you know, if you look at the median income in the United States. So that's why it became, you know, really apparent that these academies were necessary. And they are necessary, and that's why we're continuing to build them.
Was it a case of you showing interest in this idea and wanting to jump in, or did baseball approach you and try to, you know, look to tap into your knowledge to help get this thing going?
Well, I heard about it at the farm director meeting. So I was a farm director for the Angels at the time, and they introduced the thought. And that was about in 2002, I believe. And I said, wow, I went up to Jimmy Lee Solomon, who's the idea. He had pitched it at the meetings, and Sandy Alderson. And I said, wow, if you guys ever get to the point where you need some help with this, I'd love to be a part of it. And sure enough, in 2005, the phone rang, and I answered it, and it was the timing was great because I left the Angels in 2000 at the end of 2001, and then started working for a company called Big League Dreams, which builds these sports parks, and which is the number one prevalent person in regard or entity to help this travel ball entity, these travel ball industries start and really get heavily rooted, especially in Southern California, Arizona, all the warmer states here. So I left that to come over and do this here in Compton, and then we've been able to build other ones since.
Obviously, you know, land is at a premium. There's always, you know, trying to raise money to get things going. Nice to have, you know, I guess the deep pockets of Major League Baseball to start, but I imagine that's not where it ends. There's got to be other people, companies that come in and help out and keep this thing going as well, I would imagine.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, Major League Baseball steamrolled and made sure the first one was built, but the other ones are private partnerships with teams. So we go raise a lot of money, federal funds, state funds, tax breaks, you know, tax incentive income type of breaks to be able to raise a whole lot of money to be able to put these together because they're not cheap. You know, they're, you know, 6 to 10 to 12 to $15 million depending on what you build. And in cold weather cities with that big, huge indoor facility, you want to build a major league infield if you can. Indoor cages, classrooms, things that you see in the colder, what you need to function year-round. the price tag goes up quite substantially. So to build them in D.C., you know, that was a $12 million project at least. And then Philadelphia and then Cincinnati was another $9 or $10 million project. We're building one now in Dallas, which is way over $10 million, and same in Kansas City, right by the Negro Leagues Museum, which is going to be well over $10 million. You know, the price tag keeps going up as you get into colder weather cities. So, you know, we're looking to build them all throughout the South as well in warmer cities. We built our third one in New Orleans, you know, with the help of, you know, right after Katrina hit, and we were able to reestablish a couple of facilities down there and get a really great academy going in New Orleans. So Major League Baseball operates these two, Compton and New Orleans.
Visiting with Daryl Miller, former player and executive with the Angels, and now runs the Urban Youth Academy here in Compton, and helping put these together as we're talking about nationwide that they continue to build. You build the first one here. Obviously, it's a beautiful facility. Here it is. Was it an easy sell, a tough sell to get kids to come over?
Well, I think kids were intrigued by the idea, well, I could play baseball too. And I think that, you know, baseball existed, but I think the vehicle and the vision of how I could actually use baseball to get to college and maybe play pro ball was starting to evaporate. So we had to reestablish that vision, and that this is a game that you can play and remember, you know, have everyone remember history. You know, the Negro Leagues existed. There was a white league and a black league, and so this was a big deal. And baseball is in your DNA. You just don't remember, and you don't know it. And so once you reminded people of who they are and what they can be, then it becomes much easier. The only issue we have now is, you know, football's taken off, and it's blown up, and basketball's taken off, and there's a lot of people that look like inner city kids in those sports. Yeah, easy stars to pick out. And in baseball, it's a little more difficult, you know, to see who's my role model, who can I model myself after. When I was a kid, it was a lot easier. Now it's a little bit more difficult, but we're making sure those role models, you know, we have them on the wall out there. Can't see it here, but, you know, all the guys that have come through here, our Major League Baseball Academy, and now are playing in the big leagues or have made it to the big leagues. And we have the guys that have been in the big leagues in the past come out. So the kids now have role models, and they see minor leaguers that look like them and from the same area they're from that are in the systems now. So now it's becoming like a real dream, and guys that they really liked and they were, you know, competing against or with at the academy or in these leagues now are in college. So now guys are starting to go, wow, this is a viable dream. Right. It can happen.
The narrative is that, black kids are not playing baseball as much anymore. The numbers certainly prove that out across Major League Baseball. How important is it, as you mentioned, to present baseball as an opportunity to kids within an inner city who may not have, at times, maybe other avenues to be able to go to college, you know, to be able to come here and participate like this?
Well, it's really important because, you know, baseball is not that I have to be a superior athlete sport. I mean, basketball, you look at these guys that are playing in the NBA level, and even at the collegiate level, these are freakish, you know, individual athletes. And football, they're phenomenal athletes. And not that baseball, you don't need athleticism, but you look at a baseball team and you have, you know, heavy guys and fat guys and tall, skinny guys and little, tiny guys. You can be any size or shape and play the game.
Right.
And it's not really predicated on athleticism. Sure, athleticism is predicated on, you know, skill development. So you can be athletic and develop skills. You can be a superstar. You can be a little bit not as athletic and develop skills, and you'll play for a long, long time. So the whole idea is, I call it the individual determination sport. If you work hard enough, if you put enough time in, you're going to play baseball at a higher level. It's just luck, a little circumstances, not getting injured, and, you know, getting at the right team at the right time. Now, you know, you can level the playing field just through hard work. And I think that's American. That, like, speaks about, you know, what we believe the American dream is. If you work hard enough, you put your mind to it, and you want it bad enough, you can achieve whatever you want to achieve. And that's what baseball, I think, sells. Hard work, determination, and if you do what it takes, you're going to get to where you want to go.
You mentioned kids looking for role models. We see a player like Andrew McCutchen with the Pittsburgh Pirates, who has stepped forward, very visual. People talk about baseball, they need to market its stars better. Is somebody like that stepping forward? Are we seeing more guys willing to step forward that kids can look to and say, hey, that's somebody, you know, I want to look up to and be like someday?
Oh, absolutely. The Torrey Hunters and all those guys that have been very vocal and were very outspoken and very visible, you know, and making sure that people know, like you mentioned McCutchen, all the guys, Chris Archer with RBI, all those guys are really in the mix because they really want to make sure the kids know that there's a vehicle and that they would like to be part of their. Curtis Granderson stepped up huge in building his own academy in Chicago at UIC. So you're seeing some guys and put his own money into, and these guys are all doing it all across the United States quietly. And then former players are all having their influence as well. And I mimic it. I say this really reminds me of what happened in the Negro Leagues. After the Negro Leagues dissolved in, you know, the late 50s, early 60s, a lot of the guys were no longer playing, but then those are the coaches that then coached the crop that I represent. You know, the kids that came in the 60s and 70s, we were all coached by guys that played the game at a high, high level. And that's what you're seeing now, the guys that, like my age guys that in the 60s and 70s, those guys are now in the trenches doing the same thing. It's just harder because it's more expensive. It's harder to, like you already said, it's harder to find land. It's harder to find those agreements. And you're doing it on a small scale, but everyone's making a difference. And that's the great thing is I see a lot of guys I played against, guys I knew played with, guys that I knew they were in other leagues I never played against, that they're out doing their own thing in their own way, in their own city, and they're influencing people in a positive way. That's the cool thing.
Yeah. Talking with Daryl Miller of the famous Miller family, and we'll talk a little bit more about your brother and your sister and having three professional athletes out of one family in our second segment. We'll break here on Catholic Sports View, and when we come back, we'll visit further with Daryl Miller, and we'll talk about his journey and his Catholic faith, among many other topics. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back to Catholic Sports View here on Immaculate Heart Radio. I am Bob Gibson, and we're getting a chance to visit with Daryl Miller out here at the Urban Youth Academy in the city of Compton. It was the very first one built, and there's many been built since, and we talked about that in our first segment. But as we go on here, I kind of want to talk about your journey and your family a little bit as well. And, you know, you're a practicing Catholic. Talk about your journey, because you didn't start out a Catholic. You're a convert to the faith. Talk about your journey and how you got to that point in your life.
Well, I grew up Baptist and, you know, converted or became, was baptized early and gave my life to Christ when I was 16 and was active in the youth program and sang in the choir and the youth choir and traveled and all that kind of stuff with my older brother Saul, who's in the Airmen of Note for 28 years. And so we were active in the church. And then went to Cal Poly Pomona, and that's where I ended up playing baseball. I thought I was a really good football player and got recruited to a couple places, went to Arizona State and SC and a couple other places, but ended up playing baseball and played for a really good holy man named John Scalinas. And it really impacted me. And I thought, you know, he never cursed, never drank, never smoked, and we couldn't do any of that at Cal Poly. And he influenced a lot of people in such a positive way. He's that kind of guy. And he's Catholic. And so that led me to at least being a little bit more open, because being from that the other side, you're looking at Catholics in a whole different way than I look at Catholics now, obviously, because I became one. And then I met my wife, who was Catholic, and tried to bring her away from the church and get her to convert to the born-again movement. And she wouldn't leave. And then Father Al Baca invited us to start a Bible study at our church here in Orange County. And then we started a young adult group and a Bible study. And then the next thing you know, 3 years later, I started really looking at the Catholic faith in a whole different way. I saw so many holy people, so many people that really loved Christ, that spoke the way I spoke, you know, praise the Lord. And they really loved Christ. And then what really kind of cemented it for me was the Eucharist. When I looked at the truth of the Eucharist and I started getting these Scott Hahn tapes, because I really wanted to find out what the Eucharist meant, it seemed like I really wanted to receive Christ. And it reminded me of the day that I went forward, you know, to receive Christ. In the Protestant faith, that's what you do. You go forward in front of everyone and you receive Christ. And I went forward like 3 or 4 weeks in a row. And it reminded me, I just wanted God to know that I really meant it. And that, for me, mimics. And it really, in my opinion, is the Eucharist. Like, we're going and we're rededicating our life, if you will. Mm-hmm. We're receiving Christ as our Lord and Savior every single Sunday. And for Catholics to understand that, for me to understand that. That's to not be flippantly understanding that we're basically going, yes, I accept you into my heart as my Lord and Savior. And that's what we do when we receive the Eucharist, when we eat the bread and we drink the blood, that we're reconsecrating ourselves to that conversion moment. And that's why I became Catholic. And then the rest of it fell into place with Mary and the Pope and why we need that magisterium. And we have to understand, you know, the focus of the church of, you know, the truth is not debatable. Truth is truth. It's not like it doesn't change. And that's the piece that I think reminds me a lot of baseball. The rules don't change. You know, we don't widen home plate
right.
So people can throw strikes. And, you know, we don't change the rules on sanctity of life because people decide that they don't think it's not really life. Our rules don't change. And that's what's important to me as I've progressed in my faith is that this is a great church. And I'm just blessed that I had the courage to really become Catholic.
Seems like baseball is the one sport where it's okay to show your religious side or if you have a belief. And we don't see that so much in maybe some other sports or it's kind of shunned. You know, Tim Tebow was kind of put down for expressing his beliefs. But it seems like baseball is really kind of the one sport where you're allowed to have religious beliefs. And there are a lot of Catholics within the sport of baseball.
Oh, absolutely. We started a group called Catholic Athletes for Christ. And baseball's, there's a lot of guys. But there's a lot of guys in football, too. And I think, but the reason there's so many, you know, people that profess their faith in baseball especially is because it's a hard sport. It's failure ridden. It's like life. And you know what? Baseball, you need an anchor. You know, when things are going bad, you know, if you have no anchor, you're in trouble. And in life, when things are going rough, you need an anchor. And that's why baseball really mimics everyday living.
We all know an 0-for-25 slump in life.
Yeah, we all know that slump. And we can get in these slumps in life. You know, like I told you, we've had a bunch of things happen in our family. Our kids had an accident. This happened, that happened. And you're like going, wow, man, it's raining pretty hard. So we all have those slumps. And without an anchor, man, you're in trouble. And that's why I think it's really important to have that anchor, if you will.
Yeah. So obviously you come from the famous Miller family out in the Riverside area. Your brother's Reggie, your sister is Cheryl, for those who don't know. How do three professional athletes come out of the same family? What was in the water out there? What did your parents do right? They were able to raise, you know, such a great family.
You know, I think it was just my dad really wanted us to use sports. My mom and dad, they said, you know, use sports to get your education because we can't afford to send you to college. And so we just tried to be good enough at something to get to college because we knew that was there was no other option. You know, you had to go to college if you're in our family. And so I think that's how the rest of it was a little bit of this hard work and individual determination thing. Cheryl was a gifted athlete. Cheryl's like 6 years younger than me. Reggie's 7 years younger. I have a younger sister named Tammy that went to Cal State Fullerton on a volleyball scholarship. And my older brother named Saul went to JC, learned the saxophone, played saxophone at a high level, and he was in the Airman of Note in the Air Force for 20, like his last 20 years. So he's an accomplished saxophone player. So we all were pretty accomplished, at least at collegiate level, and used like whatever our talents were to get to school and get our scholarship and then move on with it. So I think that was it. And then the rest of it really is just, you know, Cheryl was a phenomenal athlete. Reggie was motivated because he was Cheryl's little brother. I was just trying to find a sport that I could get a scholarship in. And then I got lucky enough to get to baseball and become a catcher. And that changed my life. Being a catcher, because you can see my eyes aren't all that good, you know. They moved the outfield, I couldn't see, you know. So it ended up being a better place for me and a safer place, if you will.
You mentioned, obviously, you know, we talk about, you know, Cheryl played at the highest levels and wins, but there was no WNBA then, but she certainly would have been a star. We know Reggie's talent, one of the greatest shooters in NBA history. And certainly, you know what it takes to get to the major league level in the sport of baseball. Are you able to take those stories, certainly you personally and within your family, and relay those to kids out here and tell them, you know, what it takes to get on that journey?
Well, I love actually talking about that because, you know, I say, you know, my little brother and sister played, you know, this sport called basketball, and anyone can play basketball. I kind of make fun of it. And I go, but I really let them know that Cheryl was a really accomplished softball player. Reggie was a really good baseball player as well. And they had great hand-eye coordination that helped those skills play towards the other sports. So you can always take what they're doing athletically as a football or a basketball player and relate it to baseball and vice versa. So these skills are really interrelatable. And I think it's really important kids need to know that they can play more than one sport. And that's the big thing. Let's go back to where we started. You know, everyone's feeling like you have to be play that one sport when you're 10 years old, and if you don't, you're behind the eight ball. Well, the studies are telling us, UCLA released a study last summer that said the best collegiate athletes are the ones that are playing multiple sports until they're 15.2 years old. That means you're a sophomore. So if we're playing multiple sports through our sophomore year, it's really not a bad thing. It's a good thing. So the coaches need to hear this, and the parents need to hear this, because you know, multiple sport athletes make the best athletes in the collegiate level. If that's the truth and you want to play in college, then continue playing multiple sports. That should be encouraged, not discouraged. And people are discouraging you and your kids from playing multiple sports. You need to move out of that program and go to one that's going to encourage you to play multiple sports.
We know the sport of baseball is great, but the industry of baseball, or the sport of basketball versus the industry of basketball, has industry and the money that can be made within that, has that hurt, you know, the kid, as we mentioned, that's trying to specialize now and not just having fun and playing and trying to get where they need to get?
Well, the industry is the youth industry, you know, the baseball youth and the basketball and the soccer youth industry, where people have decided that that's how they're going to make a living. See, those people didn't exist 25 years ago. We didn't have these coaches that are charging $80 an hour for pitching lessons or for soccer goalie lessons or for football lessons and speed training and all these other things. So we've seen a lot of specialty people pop up everywhere making a living off and predicated to make a living off that youth environment. And that's dysfunctional. I think the sports at the top, they're trying to figure out how do we manage that. And I think that's the real issue that we're all finding, is how do football and basketball, baseball, soccer, how do we manage what's going on at the youth level? Because this is very dysfunctional. And unfortunately, kids are being hurt because they're only playing one sport. We know biologically and physiologically it produces tremendous amounts of strain on a body when you're doing one thing the same way over and over and over again as a young person.
We've kind of seen the sport of basketball plateau a little bit, I think. I mean, in my personal opinion, you know, football certainly has its issues with all the head injuries and everything going on now. And so many people talking about, hey, I wouldn't let my son, you know, play football now. The popular narrative for a while was that the numbers are down in baseball. Nobody's interested in baseball. It's too slow. Are we seeing a resurgence in baseball? Are we going to see the kids start to come back maybe to baseball as a safer alternative in sport?
Well, last year we had more African-Americans picked in the first round than we have in 20 years. So, yeah, I think you're seeing that more kids are starting to play baseball. So they didn't become first round picks yesterday. Mm-hmm. They've been in the trenches now for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, and you'll see more this coming year. So yeah, I think guys are starting to go, wow, this baseball thing isn't that bad of a gig. The only issue with baseball, in my opinion, is the number of scholarships compared to what they are in basketball and in football. You know, the number of collegiate scholarships per persons on a team, 11.7 as a max you can have at Division I level for 35 players, that's really difficult, especially if you're underserved and you don't have the money to make up that gap or the academic resources, because as we know, there's more academic money than there is scholarship money. So unless you're a 4.0 or 3.5 or somebody that can qualify academically, you're going to have a hard time in baseball. And so that's why these academies are important, because we're really preaching education and getting collegiately sound and ready and doing your SATs and ACTs and really buckling down and getting your grades, because making sure that you function and you're able to be NCAA certified. There's a distinct turnaround. Parents are starting to go, okay, this is a viable alternative. And plus they know that they can play for a lot longer, right, without getting hurt.
Thanks for joining us, Daryl. We really want to thank you for taking the time and wish you luck in continuing this mission with the Urban Youth Academy.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it very much. Mr. Gibson. The real one.
That'll wrap up another edition of Catholic Sports View. Thanks to my guests, Dane Jaco and Daryl Miller. If you want to catch this episode or any others in our archive, just simply go to OCCatholic.com/radio and click on the show of your choice. Thanks again for joining us here on Catholic Sports View. I'm Bob Gibson. We'll see you next week.